Ben doesn't realise actually, and you probably all do, is that John's first letter probably overlaps with what Ben has to say.
I realise that, yes.
So they'll all be asking you incredibly intelligent, probing questions.
Yeah, I hope so.
From the very start.
I have to adjust this a little bit. Hello everybody. I was asked to talk about Higgs and electroweak physics, and I will mostly focus on Higgs physics, as you can see here in the standard model and in supersymmetry. And in the third part, I will summarize the status, the experimental status, or the experimental issues, but from a theorist's point of view. I encourage you to ask questions. Yeah, this is your chance to ask questions either anytime during my lecture, or of course this evening in the discussion session, or if you buy me beer, I'm willing to answer any question that you have also later on. Don't be shy, yeah? This is your chance. Good. As I said, we start today with the standard model and the Higgs, and as was pointed out, there is a little bit of overlap between John's lecture and my lecture, but maybe it also doesn't hurt to see a plot for a second time, especially if it's a nice plot. Today I will first talk about Higgs theory, then in a bit more detail about electric position observables and how they can help us with respect to the Higgs. And then, in the end, I will discuss properties of the standard model Higgs boson. Good. What do we know? The standard model of electroweak and strong interactions. We know that the standard model is constructed as a quantum field theory, and the interaction comes from the exchange of the field quanta. And the main construction principle is the one of gauge invariance. Yeah? And the simplest example that you've probably seen many years ago when you studied in QED here, you take the Lagrange density of QED and you want to make invariant under gauge transformations. The gauge transformation of the field is shown here, of the two fields are shown here. You can do this. However, you notice at that moment that a mass term cannot be included in the Lagrange density. Yeah? Mass term is not gauge invariant, and that's completely fine because QED, we have the photon is massless to our knowledge, and everything looks okay. And with this principle, we can construct our standard model, and this is the summary of all the building blocks, and also this you've seen many times. And all these particles have been experimentally seen. Yeah, all of them have been seen, and nearly all of these particles received their own Nobel Prize when it was discovered. Except the gluon, I believe. The gluon didn't receive the Nobel Prize. The strange did not? Okay, I'll check that. That's strange, yes. As I said, this has been seen. But, as I mentioned before, the theory predicts massless gauge bosons. And this is where the problem starts. We know that the gauge bosons of the SU2 are massive. And, as I've shown in the little example before, explicit mass terms in the Lagrangian break the gauge invariance. And the solution that was invented many years, I think something like 40 years ago now, that could solve this problem is the Higgs mechanism. You postulate a scalar field, and then I will show this to you on the next slide in more detail. Mass terms arise from the coupling to the Higgs field. In the standard model, it's particularly simple. Of course, it's a very simple model, let's say. You introduce an extra SU2 doublet, shown here, a complex doublet with 4 degrees of freedom. And then you form this Higgs potential, which has with the second power term and the quartic term here. For the lambda, the coefficient, you don't have any choice. You have to choose lambda positive to have a potential that is bounded. If lambda would be negative at large values of the field, it would turn negative and we wouldn't have any stable minimum. This cannot be. So lambda must be positive. However, this mu squared is free and you can make a choice how to set it. And then there are two obvious possibilities. You can choose it also positive, and then everything is positive, and you get this kind of potential here, which is nice, but a bit boring. And the other more interesting choice is to have here mu squared negative, and you get out this nicely shaped potential that has this famous vacuum expectation value. The point with the lowest energy is not the zero point here. No? And you can evaluate where you find the minimum potential. And this is, if you have mu squared negative, this is then called the spontaneous symmetry breaking, introducing the vacuum expectation value. Oops, this was the wrong direction. Now, to make it a bit more explicit, let's write down the various couplings and components. First of all, if you go to the so-called unitary gauge, specifically simple choice, then the Higgs doublet looks like this. You only have here the vacuum expectation value V plus an elementary scalar field, and this is the Higgs boson. It's also, this counting rule is very famous. You start with 4 degrees of freedom. You want to give masses to 3 gauge bosons, which takes away 3 degrees of freedom to give them this extra degree, and then 1 degree of freedom remains, and this is this one Higgs boson. And if we come to supersymmetry tomorrow, then we will see how this extends and gives us more scalar Higgs particles. The Lagrange density I've spelled out here, and I said before that the mass terms arise from the coupling of the Higgs field to the gauge bosons, and this is, or to the other particles, let's say, but we start with the gauge bosons. Here we have the kinetic term with the covariant derivative, d mu and d mu, and d mu contains here the gauge fields, W and E, and of course the normal derivative here. And with this coupling, mass terms are created. I will also show you in more detail how this really works out. In addition to this, we have here the couplings to the quarks, or to leptons, to fermions, let's say. We have here the doublet, and then the Higgs field and the singlet. And also here we have the other doublet, the U-type doublet. And here the phi sub c, I will come to this, and the U. The singlet, which gives rise to the other mass terms. Now I write here the phi, which is like this, which is this phi here, and here the phi sub c. The reason is that if you have a doublet, you have one element upstairs, the other one downstairs, and it's obvious that if you couple these two together, you can only give mass to the element downstairs in this doublet. Yeah? Otherwise, this V, which gives rise to the mass term, would never reach the upper component. And therefore, you have to play a little trick. You have this phi sub c, which is I times sigma 2 times phi dagger, where sigma 2 is the Pauli, second Pauli matrix. And this little trick here moves the vacuum expectation value upstairs, and in this way, you can give masses also to the U-type quarks or the U-type fermions. Yeah? And finally, we have the Higgs potential that was spelled out in the previous slide. And with this Lagrangian here, we get gauge invariant couplings to the fields and mass terms for gauge bosons and fermions. Everything that we want, and we are happy. Now, when people say you create the mass term by the coupling to the vacuum expectation value, how does this really work? Well, we start with a free gauge boson without any coupling. And of course, then when we start, it also doesn't have any mass. So the propagator is just 1 over q squared. Now we add the coupling to the vacuum expectation values. And as you can see here, it couples twice to the vacuum expectation values. Yeah, there's a VV, let's say VV coupling. A small vacuum expectation value twice, and the gauge boson twice. And this is exactly this coupling here, 2 times the gauge boson and also 2 times the vacuum expectation value. And of course, this can happen not only once, it can happen twice, 3 times, and so on. Now, how does this modify the propagator? We start with the 1 over q squared, and then, for example, this term here first has the 1 over q squared, then it has this coupling structure here, gv over square root of 2, just for normalization, squared, and then the other part of the propagator, again, 1 over q squared. And you have to sum over all j's. This is for j equal to 1, for j equal to 2, you have this here, j equal to 3, and so on. And if you do this, this is a geometric series, it exactly ends up as 1 over q squared minus m squared, and the m squared is then given by the coupling constant squared times v squared over 2. And this is how effectively a mass term is created, just by this coupling to the vacuum expectation value. And for fermions, it's more or less the same, only that for fermions, as you can see here, there's only one vacuum expectation value coupling to the Higgs field. So we have this type of coupling, but the trick works exactly the same. 1 over q slash becomes 1 over q slash plus these terms here, where we have here g, the coupling constant, times the vacuum expectation value over square root of 2. And again, it's a geometric series, and you end up here with 1 over q slash minus the fermion mass, which is then given here with this expression. And again, the mass term is created. We have here this piece that gives us the mass term, but also we have also the coupling of one Higgs field and one vacuum expectation value to two gauge bosons, and at the same time we also get the coupling of two Higgs bosons and two gauge bosons. And one can see here by construction that the coupling of the particle to the Higgs field, of the gauge boson to the Higgs field, is proportional to the mass of the particle itself. This is one of the main characteristics of the Higgs mechanism. And this is extremely important, and we'll come back to this later on. It's similar for the mass terms for fermions. And this here is the diagram, as I've showed you before, that creates the mass for the fermions. And this here is the coupling of the Higgs to the fermions. And if you look at this equation, you see that the coupling is proportional to the mass. Finally, there is the Higgs self-coupling. There was this quartic term. And of course, if you take this, let's say, this phi to the power of 4, you get a term like this here, where the vacuum expectation value couples twice to the Higgs boson with, of course, the coupling of the quartic piece, lambda. Yeah, so this lambda here then determines also the Higgs boson mass itself, and you get this relation here. Lambda is Higgs boson mass squared over V, or you can turn it around. And this is the last unknown parameter of the standard model. Yeah? We know we've measured all the other parameters, only this parameter, because we haven't seen the Higgs boson, is not known so far, and it's the last free parameter. Now, I stressed a couple of times that the coupling of the Higgs boson is always proportional to the mass of the particle that we're looking at. Which means, if we want to establish the Higgs mechanism, and this will be part of the third lecture in 2 days, it's not only finding the Higgs, finding a particle, you also have to measure its couplings, and the couplings have to turn out right. If they don't, it's not the Higgs at work, it's something else, or we don't understand the mechanism. It's crucial that we measure the characteristics of the Higgs and that we measure its couplings to all the other particles, and they have to come out proportional to the mass. You have a question? Sorry, why? Where do you want to put a loop?
On the diagram.
Here?
Down.
Here.
Yeah.
Why do you want to put a loop? Well, this arises at tree level. Yeah? Well, you will see a diagram similar to this with a loop in a moment. Maybe then your question is answered. But this is a tree level effect, and you don't need any loops to make this work. Yeah? But you will see, maybe when I show you the diagram with the loop, it will become clear. No, this is all at tree level already. There is another famous effect of the Higgs field. Up to now, you could say, it works, it's nice, but maybe there are other mechanisms as well. Well, there was another problem that people found when they looked at the scattering of longitudinal gauge bosons, here longitudinal W bosons, and you can evaluate the cross-section or the probability for this process here, WW goes to WW, and in a theory without any Higgs, you have this type of diagrams here. Yeah? You have this S-channel exchange for photon with photon and Z, or the T-channel exchange with photon Z, and you have here these kind of quartic couplings. And you add this up, you evaluate the probability for this process, And you see that it goes with the coupling constant squared times energy squared, the energy of the incoming W bosons, divided by the W boson mass square, so a constant, plus terms of order of 1, so not going with E squared, but E to the power of 0. What does it mean? You say, okay, then it goes with E squared. Well, it means that if you increase the energy, you increase the probability more and more. And we can increase the probability only up to 1. Yeah, so something has to stop this amplitude of rising. There has to be something that stops this amplitude, which means that this theory, as it is, without a Higgs boson, is not consistent. Something will happen at higher energies. Now, we look at what happens if we just introduce a scalar particle. And then, with the scalar particle, of course I called Higgs already here, with the scalar particle you get these two additional diagrams. And you evaluate them, you evaluate the amplitude, and the result is you get here the coupling constant of the Higgs to the two W bosons squared times E squared over MW to the fourth. And now you see that this, and with a different sign. Here we have a minus sign and here we have a plus sign. And you see that you get this term here in brackets, that the dangerous term that makes our theory invalid at high energies exactly cancels if this relation here is fulfilled. Yeah, if this relation is fulfilled, this term here becomes zero, and then this here is exactly the coupling of the Higgs boson to W bosons that we had introduced anyway before. So this new mechanism gives us the masses and solves this problem at the same time, automatically, which is, at least for me, an indication that this could really be very close to the truth. Now, here we come to the diagram with the loop. What else do we know about the Higgs boson? Well, we can look at the running of the Higgs self-interaction. The Higgs self-interaction here, again, the quartic Higgs coupling is governed by this constant lambda, and John talked about these renormalization group runnings that he evaluated for people calculated for running these SUSY theories from grand unified theories down to electric energies. We just look at the running of the Higgs self-interaction, and they can be evaluated by calculating this type of loop diagrams here. And the renormalization group equation is then given by this equation here, so d lambda over dt has this prefactor, and then we have lambda squared. Lambda squared comes from this type of diagram. Lambda gt squared comes from this type of diagram. From this one here, g top to the fourth comes from. And then we have pieces coming from the electric part of the theory. Now, and t here is the logarithm of the energy scale at which you look, at which you evaluate everything, divided by the generic mass scale in this problem, which is the only mass scale that we have, the vacuum expectation value. But here in the T contains the energy dependence. Okay, you say, nice realization of equations. What do we do with it? Well, we can impose two conditions. And we will work this out on the next slide. We want to avoid the Landau pole, and I will tell you what this is, and we want to avoid vacuum instability. One is applied for large lambda and the other one for small or negative lambda. Avoid the Landau pole. Let's look at large lambda. At large lambda, we can forget about these terms here. We only look at the lambda squared term. Yeah? Only this is relevant at large lambda. And then the RGE becomes very simple. It takes this form here and we can solve this equation. And we get that lambda of q squared of the energy scale is given by lambda at v squared divided by this expression. Okay, what does it tell us? Well, we have here a 1 and then minus and another expression that depends again on q squared. It could happen that this piece here, that you increase q squared, you make this log larger, and then this piece here can become 1. And this means that your self-coupling blows up. Yeah, there's a pole, this is the so-called Landau pole, where your theory becomes non-perturbative and is not a theory that we know to work with, or that, let's say, that we want to have. Yeah, we want to have a perturbative theory also to higher energies. So if you say we don't want that lambda becomes infinite, we say that lambda at the energy scale, capital lambda, should be smaller than infinity. You can invert this and you get this expression here. You get that the Higgs boson mass square should be smaller than this expression, which again depends on the energy scale lambda. And this gives us the purely theoretical upper bound on the Higgs boson mass. Now we can come from the other direction and we say we want to avoid vacuum instability, which means we want that the potential at the vacuum expectation value is smaller than the potential at the origin. Yeah? Only then we have this nicely shaped potential. Otherwise, we would go back to this, let's say, boring potential. This can be relevant for smaller negative lambda. So we forget about all the terms in the RGE that contain a lambda, and we keep only the rest here. Again, we can solve the equation. It's even simpler now, and we get that lambda of q squared is lambda of v squared times this factor here times the log, which again contains the energy squared. If we now say lambda should be larger than zero, we get a lower bound on the Higgs boson mass squared. Yeah, we can solve this, and we get a lower bound on the Higgs boson mass squared. Again, depending here on the energy scale, capital lambda. Now we have an upper bound and we have a lower bound. Now we try to combine the two of them. As you can see here before, the top quark mass plays an essential role here. Yeah? These terms are small compared to the top quark mass. So the main parameters that enter here are lambda or the Higgs boson mass, which is the same, and the top quark mass. So we look at the plane top quark mass, Higgs boson mass, and we say we want to have a perturbative theory, let's say up to 1 TeV, 10 to the 3 GeV. And then you can see here these two lines, and it means that within all this area here, you get a theory that avoids both of the problems up to 1 TeV. Yeah? So it's a huge part of parameter space that is okay. But of course, 10 to the 3 GeV is not very high, and we want our standard model to be valid to higher energy. So one could say maybe up to the grand unification scale, which is something like 10 to the 16 GeV. And then it looks quite different already. You only have this little sliver here that gives you a viable theory up to 10 to the 16 GeV. Outside this, you run into a problem with one or the other problem. Of course, now we know the top quark mass, and if one puts the experimental value here, you can see that only a very small value of the Higgs boson mass is still compatible with the standard model perturbative up to high energy scales. And this is shown on the right-hand side here, where the top quark mass has been fixed to 174 GeV, and now everything is shown as a function of this scale lambda here. Here we have this one bound, and here we have the Landau pole bound, and only this green area here gives you a theory that really works. In other terms, if you want that your theory is valid up to the grand unification scale, only a very small range of Higgs boson masses can do this for you. This is roughly between 130 and 180 GeV. Only in this mass range, the standard model can be extended up to very high energies. So it could be that the LHC will find a Higgs boson in this mass range and nothing else. I don't hope so, but it could be. And then it could indeed be that we are stuck with a theory and we have no clue how to extend it because everything works. So let's hope that the LHC either finds it as a different mass, in a different mass range, or that at least it finds something in addition. Yeah, but we will come back to this tomorrow. Good, I said everything that can be seen here. Now, before I come to the second part, are there any more questions? Yes?
When you said that the couplings are proportional to mass, could you emphasize this?
Yes.
Why you are emphasizing, I missed that point.
I emphasized it because it's a clear prediction of this construction. We say we want to create the masses with the Higgs mechanism and we're looking for the Higgs. But we want to establish this fact experimentally. So we have to check all the predictions that are made by this theory. And the prediction that the masses are proportional to the couplings is, for me at least, it's the main prediction. And when we measure all the masses, we can also measure the coupling constants at the same time, when we see the Higgs boson, and then we have to establish that this proportionality is really fulfilled. If this would not be the case, the theory would be different. Something would be different. We will come back to this in the third lecture. I have a very nice plot showing this. But if you want to test the theory, then you have to evaluate all possible predictions and check them experimentally. And this is one of the main predictions.
Masses and masses of those particles.
Yes.
So coupling is proportional to masses of other particles.
Maybe I didn't say it clear enough. Take the B quark. We know the B quark mass, and when we find the Higgs boson, it will probably decay to B quarks, at least with a certain branching ratio, and we can measure the coupling of the Higgs boson to B quarks. And then we have to see whether this coupling that we measure in the decay is exactly the coupling that corresponds to the B quark mass. Yeah? Yeah. Well, if we have this shape here, you mean, yeah?
Yeah?
Yeah. Then we don't have any vacuum expectation value, and the whole mechanism breaks down. It doesn't work. Yeah? I am not aware of any attempt to do this with non-scalars. When this was done, people were looking for theories trying to explain the masses. This is 40 years ago, and I don't remember this very well. I'm not aware, maybe in those days people tried something different as well. I don't know, yeah? But as far as I know, this is the only possibility that works. I don't know, on the top of my head, what would fail if you would try to do it with a non-scale. Yeah? So you take precisely measured data. And at the same time, you take your favorite theory. Standard model, I would take some symmetry, maybe some people would take the Twiggs-Doublet model, extra dimensions. You take your favorite theory, and then you calculate the prediction for these observables. These observables can be calculated within the theory. I will show you in a moment how this can be done. You can make a prediction here. What happens? Well, you have loop corrections to this prediction. And these loop corrections contain the whole model. Yeah? All the particles at some point can enter into these loop corrections and in this way modify the predictions. This is why all the different models give you different answers. They have different particle contents, different couplings. They give you different answers, different predictions for these observables here. You can also play this game in the standard model, where, as I said, there is one unknown parameter, the Higgs boson mass. You can have loops, including the Higgs boson, and then you get a different answer depending on which Higgs mass you insert in your calculation. No? And in this way, it's possible to obtain limits on the Higgs boson mass from the measurement of other data. Of course, one needs very high accuracy of both the measurements and the theoretical predictions. Yeah, and there was a tremendous effort over the last 10, 20, 25 years to improve both the measurements and the theoretical predictions to a level that it can really tell you something. Well, we'll see this in a moment. Here, the first prediction for the W boson mass. In the standard model, one can derive a very simple relation connecting the W boson mass to other well-known quantities. This is this relation here at tree level. We have the W boson mass, the Z boson mass is well measured, the fine structure constant and the Fermi constant are also well measured, and also pi and square root of 2 are quite well known. And then you can invert this here and you get out the W boson mass. Fine. Of course, I said this would be boring. The interesting thing happens if you include loop corrections. Loop corrections are summarized in this case in a quantity called delta R. I will not go into details how you calculate this. Can be calculated, and in fact, the first calculation here has been done now 29 years ago. It's a really long time, by Marciano and Zirlin. And okay, Zirlin was the PhD advisor, and Marciano was the PhD student. And I was postdoc at the institute where Marciano was professor later, and he told me that when he was doing this calculation for his PhD, he talked to his wife, and he said, you know, I have to calculate these corrections for masses of particles that don't even exist, and I don't know why I'm doing this. So if you're frustrated at some point and don't know why what you're doing in your PhD, there's hope. It can turn out to be very important. They did this first one loop calculation here, and in the standard model at one loop, this delta R contains three pieces. One is called delta alpha, it's a shift in the fine structure constant, and contains these large logarithms, log of mz over fermion masses, and the size is roughly 6%. The second piece, also quite famous, is the so-called rho parameter. This delta rho here, which goes with the top quark mass squared. And finally, the so-called remainder piece here depends on the Higgs boson mass, more precisely depends on the logarithm of the Higgs boson mass over the W boson mass. This dependence here, the quadratic dependence of the rho parameter on the top quark mass, led to a prediction of the top quark mass long before the top quark was actually discovered. And it proved that this method and principle can work. Yeah, the prediction agreed quite good with the mass that was later on measured. Yeah, so it works. Of course, as you can see here, you have a quadratic dependence on the top quark mass, and you only have a logarithmic dependence on the Higgs boson mass, which makes it much more difficult for the Higgs boson, or for the mass, to be determined. The second observable that is quite relevant is the effective weak mixing angle, which is defined here by the ratio of the couplings of the Z boson to the fermions measured at the Z pole, the vector coupling and the axial coupling, and here this is the charge of the fermion, and also here higher order corrections enter and modify this prediction. Now you can put this together for the W boson mass. Here I spelled out this leading term here at one loop, the prefactor and then the log m Higgs over mw. And what you get is, okay, this here is the plane, top quark mass, W boson mass. This is a very new plot, actually. You get this green band here. This is the prediction within the standard model for the W boson mass depending on the top quark mass. Yeah, so this green band here is the prediction of the standard model. The last free parameter that enters here is the Higgs boson mass. At this limit here, we have 114 GeV, which corresponds roughly to the lab bound. And then we increase the mass and we go away. Here we have 300 GeV and here we have 1000 GeV. And this little white line here, I will come to this also on Wednesday, I think. This is the area that has been excluded by the Tevatron recently. So above here we have the lab exclusion limit, and this one here is excluded by the Tevatron. Now, I said before, we make the prediction, and we have to compare the prediction with the experimental values. And this blue ellipse here shows you the experimental result, and this was the update that came out, I think, 1-2 weeks ago. There was a new combined value for the W boson mass from all the measurements that we have from LEP and from CDF and D0. And one can see here at the 68% confidence level, there is a little overlap region. Of course, it would go to the 95% confidence level. I have a plot of this tomorrow. This extends further to the standard model region. And of course, the standard model is still fine and can accommodate the precision of the W boson mass. On the other hand, you see already in this little exercise that the standard model works best with low Higgs boson masses. Yeah, the standard model would prefer here, the central value would prefer a Higgs boson mass of roughly 50 GeV. Yeah, but if you go to the edge of the ellipse, then you can also accommodate 114 GeV or even slightly higher values. But one can see here what I was trying to say in the beginning, that it is possible, using precision observables, to obtain bounds on unknown parameters or to obtain knowledge on unknown parameters. And we know here that the light Higgs boson mass is preferred in the standard model. One other thing that is interesting to observe, I told you here at one loop, all these precision observables only have a logarithmic dependence on the Higgs boson mass. This changes at higher orders. The leading two-loop piece here goes with the Higgs boson mass squared over W boson mass squared, but of course has an additional coupling constant squared in front, so this piece is much smaller than the other ones, than the one-loop pieces. You find this dependence, but it's weaker because of this additional coupling constant. This here is a brief overview about the predictions that the various precision observables that have been measured at LEP and SLD, what they tell you in terms of the Higgs boson mass. Let's start with the W boson mass here. This one corresponds to this line here. The central value, as I said, is roughly 50 GeV, and then the 1 sigma errors from the W boson mass are given by these error bars here. This green area is the 1 sigma area preferred in a combined fit. I will come back to this, I think, on the next slide. This is the preferred area. And this black line here is the lab bound of 114 GeV. So it's just coincidence that it agrees with this point. It's nothing to do with it. What can we see? We can see that there are three observables that are particularly sensitive. It's the W boson mass. It's the left-right asymmetries of leptons measured at SLD at SLAC. And it's the forward-backward asymmetry of B quarks measured at lab 1. And we can also see that they do not agree very well with each other. Yeah, if you take these two ones and this one here, this has been a long-standing disagreement, especially between this left-right asymmetry and the forward-backward asymmetry. They disagree for, I don't know, 10 years more or more by more than 3 sigma. And nobody knows what's going on or why this happens. Can be a fluctuation, can be that one of the measurements has an unknown problem. People investigated this a lot, didn't find anything, so we are stuck with it. And since these measurements will be updated, possibly only in the somewhat further future, we will have to live with at least these two measurements here for the next 10 years or more. On the other hand, these two measurements, the left-right asymmetry and the W boson mass, they agree quite well with each other, and they are kind of leptonic observables, which are often considered as safe observables, because if leptons are in the game, things are nicer than if you have quarks or hadrons in the game. And only in the combination with the forward backward asymmetry of B quarks you get this one sigma preferred region that is somehow still compatible with the lab bound. If this measurement wouldn't be here, the standard model would be dead already. Yeah? Then the indirect data would tell us that the preferred value would be much lower at something like 40 or 50 GeV, and it couldn't be accommodated with the precision, that the lab bound couldn't be accommodated with the precision data anymore. This would not be possible. So it's this one measurement here that keeps the standard model alive. But it's there, and it's of course not allowed to be neglected, yeah, as much as some people would like to do. Now, this is the famous blue band plot that combines all the information that we have in the standard model about the Higgs boson mass. And so you do a fit to all the precision observables, to all those ones, and even a few more. But as we can see here, the three most relevant ones are given here. You do a fit to all the data, the chi-squared fit, and then the minimum chi-squared gives you the preferred Higgs boson mass value, which is currently at 87 GeV, here at the minimum. And then the delta chi-square tells you how probable is to go to another Higgs boson mass value. So, for example, the 2 sigma range is at the delta chi-squared of 2.7 and is given at 1 with 157 GeV. So, within the standard model, the Higgs boson mass should be lighter than 157 GeV at the 95% confidence level. If the standard model is realized with the Higgs boson, it should be lighter than this value. But this is also reflected in these two errors, of course, which then at the 2 sigma level somehow make up this upper bound. What we can also see here, this yellow region is the lab exclusion bound. Of course, it's 114 GeV, it extends beyond the central value, but at the delta chi square equal to 1 level, you can still accommodate the electric precision data with the lab bound. This yellow sliver here, again, is the area excluded by the Tevatron between 160 and 117 GeV. Of course, in this plot here, the direct limits are not included. I will show you one where it is included on the next slide. But here it's purely from indirect data. Yeah, you get this. Again, a word of caution here, and I said it, but I will say it again. The assumption that was made to do this fit was we have the standard model and the Higgs boson. So, as nicely as this looks, it's not a confirmation of the Higgs mechanism. If you assume the Higgs, then we know the mass. But if the Higgs is different, then this plot doesn't tell us anything. Yeah? It's just something that works strictly in the standard model. But we will see how you can do it in supersymmetry as well tomorrow. As I said, here the direct limits have not been included. If you include the direct limits, there's another group, the G-fitter group, that did it. Then, of course, this allowed area does not extend into this area, in the lab exclusion area, a lot, only a little bit here, with a high chi-square penalty. And this Tevatron exclusion region also gives you a chi-square penalty. And then this here is the deformation of the blue band that we've seen on the previous slide. And if you go to the delta, now we have the double-sided, so the delta chi-square equal to 4 gives you the 2 sigma limit. And here the Higgs boson mass should be lighter than 152 GeV. It's even a little bit lower because here it's driven, the chi-square is driven to higher values because of the Tevatron exclusion. But again, we see that the Higgs boson should be somewhere here. And we will see tomorrow, or on Wednesday, that the area or the region of parameter space that is currently preferred is a particularly tricky region for all the colliders. For lab, of course, it's tricky because it ran out of energy, and for the others, we will see on Wednesday. How will this develop in the future? Let's start here with the effective weak mixing angle. Today, we are at an error of 16 times 10 to the minus 5. At the Tevatron and the LHC, hardly any improvement can be expected. Maybe they will be able to measure at the same level of accuracy, and then you can combine them and gain a little bit. This remains to be seen. The ILC, the International Linear Collider, I know this is here meant to be an LHC school, but one should also to always think a little bit ahead, and the ILC is a very nice project, I think. There itself you couldn't do anything, but the ILC has, a sub-experiment. You can run the ILC also at the Z-pole, like LEP and SLD were running, at very high luminosities. And then you could measure all these Z-poles on observables, all these asymmetries with very high accuracy, and you could gain more than a factor of 10 here in the effective weak mixing angle. Because you could produce so many Z-bosons, this termed giga-Z. Yeah. What about the W-boson mass? We were at 25, and this has been updated 1 week ago to 23 MeV, which is already quite impressive. These are MeV, and the W-boson mass is 80 GeV, so it's a very high accuracy already. One hopes at the Tevatron, with future measurements, to get down to something like 20 MeV, maybe a bit better, we will see. At the LHC, one was thinking about 15 MeV. I just discussed with Albert before that new problems, new issues seem to have appeared, so it's under discussion whether this 15 can really be reached at the LHC, but this is still the goal that we go for. At the ILC, one can get down to 10 MeV, and if you go to the WW threshold and measure with very high luminosity, the W boson mass, you can get down to 7 MeV. But this is everything that can be done. The top quark mass is important. I told you before, it enters quadratically into all these precision observables, and it has to be under control very well. Today, we are at 1.3 GeV uncertainty, already quite impressive. At the Tevatron and later the LC, we hope to go down to, let's say 1 GeV here, at the ILC to 0.2, and at GigaZ, because of an improved measurement of the strong coupling constant, one can hope to go down to 0.1 GeV. And you can compare this top quark mass precision with the uncertainty that is induced into the calculation by the experimental uncertainty of the top quark mass. If you vary the top quark mass within its error, it gives you a spread in the prediction of the precision observables, which is an uncertainty, and you have to reduce it. And here one can see how various top quark masses induce uncertainties, and one can also see that it would be very nice to have the top quark mass at the level of 0.1 GeV to have these additional uncertainty under control. Yes? Very good question and a very important point. The issue is that a fermion mass, a quark mass, is not well defined because quarks do not exist as single objects. Yeah? So we can never observe one top quark and measure its mass, contrary to, let's say, a tau lepton, which can be measured by an electron. So one has to think about a good definition of a top quark mass, and there are several definitions around, and one believes that as long as we are at the level of 1 GeV, it doesn't matter so much. Yeah, we hope to what we measure at the Tevatron, for example, is more or less the pole mass, and there might be corrections to that at the level of lambda QCD or so, but this is 200 MeV. So with 1 GeV or the 1.3 GeV where we are currently, we are still fine. If one goes down, one has to define a new top quark mass, and I think the best option there is a so-called threshold mass. If you go to the ILC and you measure the top, you measure the E plus and minus going to TT bar, you measure the threshold, the rise of the threshold with energy, and you can scan this, make an energy scan and go along this threshold. And this is then, as I said, the so-called threshold mass. This can be converted by higher order corrections to other definitions of the top quark mass that you want to use in your calculation. The calculation I've shown you have used the on-shell top quark mass, could be done also with another definition, the definition with the MS-bar top quark mass, for example. But as long as we are at this level of accuracy, this is not a big issue. This is what people believe. Yeah, but one has to keep this in mind, and as one goes down, one really has to think about it very hard. this here is a projection, what can be expected from the future, from how this blue band ellipse would change. So the blue band here, because it's from G filter, is green. This is the current, let's say, width of the blue band. However, one has to be careful here, the central value has been moved for clarity reasons to 120 GD, but just an overall shift, nothing more. Yeah, just don't get confused. They just artificially moved central value to 120 GD, and then this is the precision that we have nowadays. If one looks at what we can get at the LHC, the improvement in the precision data, if you make the precision data better, more precise, then the ellipse will become smaller. Yeah, the precision on the Higgs mass will become better, or the errors become smaller, which means the ellipse here has to become a bit, stiffer. Yeah? Then you get this blue one out. If you go to the ILC, you get this red one out, again better. If you go to the GigaZ option, you get this one out. You can see with the GigaZ option, you can get an indirect determination of the Higgs boson mass up to, let's say, plus minus 5G. Yeah, which is quite impressive. And this would be a very important precision test. Let's assume we measure the Higgs boson mass, we measure all the precision observers in the future. Then the directly measured value has to agree with the indirect determination. Yeah, and since we can be very precise with this indirect determination, this will be a very important and very strong test of the standard model. If we would find a deviation, let's say we find exactly this parabola here, but we measure the Higgs boson mass at 150 GeV, then we know something is wrong. There must be other scales in the game. There must be particles that we have not seen yet that move the precision data down to 120 GeV, from away from 150. Yeah? This is a very important test in the future. I want to say a few words on G-2 already. John also talked about this, but since this will be important also tomorrow, maybe I say a few words about this. Let's first look at the experiment. This experiment was done at Brookhaven Lab, and I was very lucky because I was a postdoc at Brookhaven Lab when the first results were announced in 2000, I think it was. So it was, there was a very big hype about this, and everybody was very enthusiastic. This is also where Marciano, the guy who didn't know why he was doing his PhD, is professor. So it was a very cute experiment, very small. I had a look at this ring once. It's really, it fit in here more or less. You take protons, you hit a target, you get pions. The pions decay to muons, and the muons are these little cones with a little round arrow indicating their spin. And these muons were fed into this storage ring, quite small, as I said, diameter of 40 meters. And if you align things correctly, what you get is that the direction of flight of the muons exactly agrees with this spin direction. Yeah? And therefore, these little circuits are always aligned with the flight, with the line of the direction of the flight. What happens? After some point, of course, also the muons decay. They decay to electrons and neutrinos. Of course, you can see only the electrons. You measure the electrons with detectors. And then with these electron detectors, you can see how the spin of the muons was really aligned. Because this is where the interesting part enters. The anomalous magnetic moment of the muon induces a small disalignment of the direction of flight and the spin here. Yeah? And by measuring this discrepancy, let's say, one can get a handle on the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. So you have the muons here, they decay, and then from the direction how they decay, you can get the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. To look at it from a bit more theoretical side, this is the part of the Lagrangian that is responsible for this. We have here the fermion and the other fermion and the photon. Of course, the photon is the one that keeps the muons here in the storage ring, yeah, the coupling, the electromagnetic coupling of the muons that keeps it there, coupled to the photon. And here we have the normal piece that is already there, tree level, just with the gamma matrix. And as I said, this is the piece at tree level already. And then there is a second piece that arises only at the loop level here with a more complicated structure, more complicated. complicated Dirac structure. And this F2 at zero external momentum is the allowance emanating moment of the muon. Yeah? So from this mu photon coupling that we have here at the loop level, you can get out the allowance emanating moment of the muon. Now, as John said already before, there are two methods to one has to determine the standard model value, the standard model prediction. And there is one piece in the standard model prediction which cannot be predicted from pure theory, but needs some experimental data in order to evaluate it. Do I have, maybe I have in the diagram here? Yeah, it's this type of diagrams here. Yeah, where you have here a photon exchange and then another particle running around in the loop. This type cannot be evaluated for the quarks because, coming back to the other problem, we don't know the quark masses exactly. And we need a very precise value of the quark masses there. So this piece has to come from experimental data. And it was said before, there are two methods to do this. There is the method using the plus and minus data. You take the plus and minus going to hadrons, because you have a photon, and then going to hadrons, this is kind of this quark loop cut into two. And there's another method using tau decay data by inverting the tau decay data also to this process. So far, there was always a problem with the tau data. I have to phrase it differently. There was no good agreement between the prediction from tau data and from the plus and minus data. Yeah, there was a discrepancy of 2 to 3 sigma. And people were insecure about the tau data because of this transformation process that you have to apply. And were more confident with the plus and minus data. And in the past years, basically only plus and minus data has been used in order to predict the standard model value. And the result is shown here. It's from this group, for example, here. This here corresponds to the standard model prediction, and this is the experiment, and one can see that there is a discrepancy at the level of 3-point-something sigma. Yeah? And all evaluations based on the plus and minus data show this kind of discrepancy. What about the status of this kind of measurement and prediction? Well, from the experiment, as I said, the experiment gave or was evaluated data from 2001 to 2006, and everything is stable, all the various parts of the measurements, everything agreed very nicely, and the final error is at the level of 6 times 10 to the minus 10. It's incredible, isn't it? Something that you predict at the level of 10 to the minus 10, and you also calculate it at the level of 10 to the minus 10, and more or less this agreed. So this has been done at this level. From the theory side, there are two important contributions. One is the so-called light-by-light contribution, which is depicted in this diagram here, the muon, the coupling to the photon. And then you have here three photons, and again, the quark loop, or whatever goes around there. The problem is that you evaluate this at low energies. I told you that this F2 from the Lagrangian has to be taken at zero external momentum, so you have a very low momentum here, which means that also the momenta in here are very low. And if we know that if we have quarks at very low energies, things become non-perturbative and it's very difficult to calculate it. And there have been three independent calculations of this type of diagram, which gave one value. And then a few years later, there was another calculation that said, yeah, we get the same value, but with another sign. Yeah, so the sign flipped more or less. And shortly afterwards, all these three calculations said, yeah, oh, we made a sign error. So, and they made different sign errors. Probably one made the first sign error, and then the other one worked on his calculation until it also got a sign error. I don't know. But there were three calculations, all with a sign error, but this has been corrected in 2002. And since then, this is also quite stable. The other one is what I told you before, the hadronic vacuum contribution from this type of diagrams. And so far, in most evaluations, the tau data is not used. I wrote here, this is the status of June or July 2009. Also, John mentioned that there is now a new measurement from Barbin, also in plus and minus data that doesn't seem to be so well. I will not go into too many details. Yeah? We will just look at the results. If you use the plus and minus data, you get out this kind of discrepancy. These are different people or groups that did this evaluation. And I like to say that here, a 3 sigma deviation has been established, which is interesting. I mean, it's just one number. Yeah, but the experiment was designed to produce exactly one number, and then you find a discrepancy. And some people say, oh, this doesn't tell me anything. To me, it's at least very interesting. And we will see tomorrow how this can be used. This was this new development that also John mentioned. There was a re-evaluation of the tau data by this group here, where this was an earlier tau-based evaluation, and this was the new tau-based evaluation. And one can see it moves substantially into the direction of the plus and minus data. And now the tau data alone gives you nearly 2 sigma deviation. But this still has to be confirmed. If this stays like this, then one could attempt to form a new average of everything and say maybe this is just this is just fluctuation that they don't agree. We will see how this continues. Now, one can ask the question, can we use also the unknown of the muon to place bounds on the Higgs boson mass? In principle, yes, because the Higgs boson mass also enters in this type of contribution. You can imagine a one loop diagram. You have two muons and a photon, and then you have a loop where the two muon lines, or where the muon couples to the photon, and the Higgs boson is exchanged. This would be a contribution, including the Higgs boson. But here, the mass of the muon enters quadratically on both sides, yeah? Because the Higgs boson couples twice to the muon, and then this contribution is suppressed. The only good contribution that you get arises at higher orders, and this is an example of the Higgs mass dependence at the two-loop level that has been evaluated. And here, this is the dependence on the Higgs mass on this contribution, and you can see that the variation is very small. It goes here from 1.8 to 2.3 times 10 to the minus 10, so it's 0.5 times 10 to the minus 10, and it's not enough to give you a good handle within the standard model on the Higgs boson mass. So in the standard model, it doesn't help much. In the MSSM, and this will come tomorrow, it will help a lot. Therefore, I showed this. Good, this was precision observables. Any more questions here? Yes?
G mu
is the Fermi constant. Just one of the Fermi coupling constant, which has been measured. This is 1 times 10 to the minus 8. 1.1 times 10 to the minus 8 or so. Just has been measured from interactions of gauge bosons, for example. As I said, you can ask later today, or you can buy me beer in one of the cups. We come to the last part, which is rather short, although it's very important. Properties of the standard model Higgs boson. Oh, exactly here, again, it enters, yeah, your G mu. The coupling of the Higgs to fermions is given by this coupling constant. Before it was parameterized in terms of alpha. Now I put here G mu for convenience. This is somehow normal notation. So we get here the coupling constant, which is proportional to the mass of the fermion itself. We can evaluate the decay width. The width of the Higgs going to fermion looks like this here, the number of colors. Then again, this G mu, the mass of the Higgs boson to the power of 1, the fermion mass squared, and I wrote here, and I will tell you why, evaluated at the Higgs boson mass squared, times this kinematic factor. Now, you may ask, why should we insert here not this value as a coupling constant, yeah, this MF, but the MF at the scale of the Higgs boson mass? This, at least for quarks, it has been shown that the bulk of QCD corrections to this decay here, and they are of course relevant for the decay to quarks, the bulk of the QCD corrections can be absorbed by going from the pole mass to the mass at the scale of the Higgs boson. As an example, the decay to bottom quarks is very important, yeah, because the bottom quark is a relatively heavy quark. The pole mass is is something like 4.8 GeV. If we assume a Higgs mass of 120 GeV, the bottom quark mass at this scale is only something like 2.9 GeV, or 3 GeV. So if you square this, you go from 4.8 squared to 3 squared. This is a huge reduction in this behavior from QCD corrections. But they can be incorporated relatively simply by going here to the mass of the fermion at the scale of the Higgs boson. As said, the dominant decay process for most Higgs bosons that we expect is this one. Of course, if the Higgs boson would be heavier than 350 GeV, the decay to top quarks is open. On the other hand, we've seen before that in the standard model, at least, we don't expect a Higgs boson with this high mass. Yeah, it wouldn't be compatible with the precision data. The decay can also happen to fermions. Again, we have here G mu as a coupling constant, and then the fermion mass squared. And if you evaluate the decay width for the case that the Higgs boson mass is larger than 2 times the gauge boson mass, so an on-shell decay to 2 gauge bosons, you get here a coupling constant now with a third power of the Higgs boson mass and some other corrections here and the kinematic factor. It can also happen that the Higgs boson decays to 2 gauge bosons below the threshold, and then one of the gauge bosons is off-shell and decays as an off-shell gauge boson to other particles, to standard model fermions. This is also possible, and if you evaluate it, well, you get a bit more complicated formula with the first power of the Higgs boson mass only and the integral that I didn't spell out. But it's very important that this decay is possible. Yeah? For example, one of the main search modes of the Tevatron currently is Higgs going to WW star, below, to a large extent, below the WW threshold. And this is possible because this decay is below the threshold. There's also the decay to massless gauge bosons. How can this be? The Higgs doesn't couple to massless gauge bosons, otherwise they wouldn't be massless. Well, it can happen, of course, via loops. Yeah, we have here the decay to 2 gluons that proceed mainly through the top quark loop. And we can also have the decay to 2 photons, which goes through mainly to the W boson. Let's look at the decay to gluons. We have this coupling here, Fermi constant, then the strong coupling constant squared, and the third power of the Higgs boson mass. And then I write here 1, this is the tree level contribution, and then another power of alpha s, which indicates that this is the first higher order correction. And the important thing is to calculate this coefficient here. I mean, that it goes with alpha s over pi is trivial. The question is, how does the coefficient look like? And the coefficient, I spelled it out here, is large, yeah? 215 over 12 is large. Okay, it gets reduced to some extent, but it is a very large one-loop correction, and one has evaluated for this reason also 2 and higher order corrections to this, yeah? There's a very huge correction appearing. For the decay to 2 photons, is that mainly through the W boson loop and also through the top quark loop, and then you get this expression. This is an overview about the branching ratios. This is the Higgs boson mass, and this is the branching ratio, so the probability that the Higgs boson of this mass decays to this set of particles. At low mass is 100 GeV. Here starts out with BB bar, and then also important are tau tau, blue blue, CC bar, and then here lower gamma gamma, for example. If you increase the mass, then these blue lines become more important, and these are the decays to gauge bosons. And they set in much below the threshold. Yeah? At 130 or so, 135, here the crossing between WW and DB bar takes place, and then the gauge boson, decays to gauge bosons become important. Here is the point where the off-shell decay, where the on-shell decay to the W boson sets in. So at low Higgs masses, we have a very rich spectrum of decay modes. Higher Higgs mass, it becomes more boring. At certain mass scales, you can only evaluate, or you could possibly only see the decay to gauge bosons. If this would be the case, we would still learn something, but it would be a pity that we cannot confirm these couplings here to the fermions. But well, we will see. We expect that the Higgs boson mass is below 150 GeV, and this would allow us to measure all this rich structure. So, in principle, they are very possible. Finally, last slide, the total Higgs boson width, you sum up all the thing you can decay with. It starts out very low. Here is a function of the exponential mass, and then the decay to gauge boson sets in and rises strongly in this part of parameter of space, and then continues to rise here, and even going into regions where the Higgs boson is not considered a particle anymore. The width of the particle is at the same level as the mass itself. The concept of the particle is questionable. But of course, we know that we run into other problems anyway. W bosons become so strong here. This is the branching ratio. So the if one decay becomes stronger, then the others become suppressed at the same time. Because the on-shell decay sets in. This is exactly where the on-shell decay sets in, and then you come closer to the Z boson on-shell decay, and this averages out. And you had two questions, you said? Or? See that the width is then at the same order of the mass. Yeah, and let's say the definition of a particle, let's say things that you want to have a localization of the particle. Yeah, if the width is very large, it somehow doesn't fit into the concept of the particle anymore. But I'm not sure in how much this has been actually evaluated, what really happens. I mean, you can try to do all your calculations also at X ranges and can evaluate the decays to various particles and what can be seen, but yeah, it doesn't fit in.
Can I ask,
we will, if the Higgs mass is larger than 250 GeV, let's say. We discover the Higgs at the LHC, I hope, and then we see that it decays to gauge bosons. Yeah, the branching ratio to gauge bosons is large. The decay to all the other particles is very improbable, yeah, because the branching ratio is very low. Only 1 in 1,000 would decay to VB bar. And to dig out a decay to VB bar is difficult anyway at the LHC. Yeah, and if the number of decays to VB bar is so low, because it's so much suppressed, it will not be visible. And this means, what I told you before, what we have to do, that we have to measure the coupling of the Higgs to the B quark, will not be possible at this mass range, because we simply don't see the decay. You expect from a standard model Higgs boson, this is what we were talking about today, I think we are safe. Yeah, this could not have been overlooked. And it was also not necessary to change any triggers because this behavior of standard model Higgs was known before. So I think this is impossible. What of course is possible is that the Higgs boson in extended models, I wouldn't say has been overlooked, but the mass limit is not 114.4 GeV. I will show you some plots tomorrow for the MSSM, where you have a reduced coupling of the Higgs to Z bosons. Okay, I will show you tomorrow or on Wednesday. But you have a reduced production cross-section and maybe reduced decay to the preferred particles, and then you are not as sensitive in your searches, and therefore the mass limit goes down. So this is possible. There are even relatively simple models that still allow for Higgs boson masses around 10, 15, 20, 40 GeV that could be there that have not been seen.
As you said, to find the Higgs, we have not just to see the peak and measure the mass, but also the cap. So in this case in which the mass is high and we are not able to measure the cap, how does it work?
I have a few plots, I think it's also on Wednesday, which have been done for also this mass range, where some of the measurements can still be done, but not at the LHC. If you really want to measure the couplings, then we have to go to a better machine, which would be the ILC. The ILC would be ideal to measure the characteristics of the Higgs boson and also go to higher mass and still be able to see something. Yeah? But at the LHC, there's no hope.
But I mean, what I mean is, you said that to claim we find the Higgs, we cannot just see the peak, but also, I mean, we have to be able to measure the cupping. So the question is, if we are able to say, okay, this is the Higgs, so if we just see the peak and we're not there.
Well, the question is always, when are you happy? Yeah, or when are you content with what you've seen? And this is often a personal choice. Yeah, if we see, let's say, we see a Higgs boson at this high mass, and for some reason the electric precision data then also tells us that this mass range is preferred. Or we see a scalar particle that decays to W and Z bosons with the right coupling. Then most people would probably say, yeah, everything that can be seen fits, and would be happy. Others, but I'm sure there are also many people, many theorists that would develop new models going beyond the standard model that have exactly this part right, but predict many other things also. Yeah, it always depends on when you're happy, but yeah. I would probably be happy, yeah? Yeah. They are searching also for masses somehow below 114 GeV. The problem with the Tevatron, and I will also come back to this on Wednesday, but, is that the main decay modes there, for example, is tau tau. If you go to lower masses, then you have the background from the Z boson going to 2 taus, which makes it very difficult in this mass range. But a little bit below they can go. However, the models that I was mentioning before, where we know that the mass ranges are lower, it's very difficult to cover this, yeah, because these are notoriously difficult models or parameter parts of parameter space. And the Tevatron is not a very clean machine. It's a Pt-bar collider. Yeah? That's how it is. And it's difficult to compete with a clean E plus and minus collider there. Yeah? Okay, I wouldn't probably work personally on the decay of the Higgs to top quarks. What people certainly are working on is the coupling, or how to measure the coupling of the Higgs to top quarks. This still can be done, despite not being able to see this decay. This could be done, for example, because the Higgs decays via top quark group to two gluons. Yeah, or it contributes to the decay to two photons. So if you measure these decays, you can get a handle on the top coupling, without being able to see the decay. Why people are calculating, let's say in the standard model, a decay that can basically not occur in the standard model anymore, I don't know. I probably wouldn't do it. But the coupling itself can be accessed, is very important, and it has to be, well, we have to try to measure it.